we must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
King also called unions the first and greatest anti-poverty program, and he famously asked, "What good does it do to be able to eat at a lunch counter if you can't buy a hamburger?"
I still believe that we can build this society of brotherhood and this society of peace.
A lot of these insurgents came to Washington, D.C. on Amtrak. They were belligerent on Amtrak trains. They refused to wear masks. They had their signs and their paraphernalia. They were screaming and yelling at other passengers that they were belligerent to our conductors.
His tenure as a National Labor Relations Board General Counsel was almost uniquely anti-labor in terms of his leanings. He really just sought to gut the agency as best he could.
You know, I am a paid registered lobbyist. The legislators hear from me all the time. They don't hear from the people I represent all the time. And so those voices, your voices out there listening to this podcast, can be really powerful.
We've had the highs and the lows. Travel's my passion, and I love to travel, and I enjoy helping my members.
So what I do is I trace the kind of history of populist, genuine populist movements in American life, but also the history of people who hate populism.
In those first 100 days, they enacted controls over the banks. They enacted the National Industrial Recovery Act, which, as long as we're on a labor podcast, it's important to note, it actually included, number one, the very first federal minimum wage.
Hey, welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 80 shows that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. On today's show, Labor Radio on KABU and Building Bridges on WBAI explore and celebrate Martin Luther King Jr.'s struggles for labor rights and economic justice. Then, labor news headlines of the week, including Talking Smart's report on insurrectionists on trains, Your Rights at Work on President Biden firing the anti-union general counsel at the National Labor Relations Board, and, from the other Washington, the upcoming legislative session in Olympia on the Working to Live in Southwest Washington podcast. We get ultra-local with the 141 Report, a brand new member of the network, which visits with Wendy Goodell, president of Machinist Local 1782, and then we zoom back out for historical overviews. Thomas Frank, author of What's the Matter with Kansas, talks with the Heartland Labor Forum about his new book about American populism and the long trail of elites who hate it. And from the Empathy Media Lab, Harvey J. Kay talks about another moment of great crisis in American history and the effect on working people. I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on today's Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, bringing you working people's voices with a selection of highlights from the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Here's the show.
Welcome to Labor Radio. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilliland.
Thank you so much for joining us. Just quickly before we jump into the show today, I'd like to give a special thanks and shout out to the Labor Radio Podcast Network for hosting podcasted versions of our show each month. Be sure to check that out at laborradionetwork.org. And so now into the regular part of our show. It is Martin Luther King Jr. Day here in the United States. And if you have been listening to KABU at all throughout the rest of the day, you will no doubt have heard some great programming regarding the life and the legacy of Martin Luther King. For our part in that, on Labor Radio, we would like to discuss something more specific to our topic, which is his role in the labor movement. And so that's what we're going to be discussing today. And so, yeah, in our era right now, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is primarily remembered as a hero of the civil rights movement and a leading activist in the struggle for racial equality. However, a part too often left out of his story is that, by his own estimation, he was also unequivocally an activist in the struggle for labor rights and economic justice. At the time of his assassination on April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. was in Memphis, Tennessee for his second visit to support the city's striking sanitation workers who were members of AFSCME. As John Nichols in The Nation wrote, King died while defending the right of public employees to organize labor unions and to fight for the preservation of public services. After observing the legal victories won for civil rights and how they had not improved the material conditions of life for many African Americans, King began to sharply focus his efforts on winning victories for economic justice. In the year leading up to his death, Dr. King began organizing what he called the Poor People's Campaign. This campaign demanded economic and human rights for poor Americans of diverse backgrounds. Included within those demands was an economic bill of rights, styled after a similar proposal from FDR during the New Deal era, more than two decades earlier. The Bill of Rights asked for the federal government to prioritize helping the poor with a $30 billion anti-poverty package that included a commitment to full employment, a guaranteed annual income measure, and more low-income housing. So this is just a bit of an insight into King's role as not only a fighter for civil rights and racial equality, but also as a unabashed supporter of labor rights and the right to unionize, which, as I did mention before, like that is something that is largely left out of his modern day legacy, at least when it gets whitewashed by corporations thanking MLK on MLK Day or like politicians talking about it. But this is a very real and a very intense part of his legacy that it still rings true today. The things he said more than half a century ago are just as relevant today regarding labor rights and, of course, racial equality as well. King also called unions the first and greatest anti-poverty program, and he famously asked, "What good does it do to be able to eat at a lunch counter if you can't buy a hamburger?" That is, of course, obviously speaking specifically to segregation and segregated restaurants and everything at that time, but the sentiment still rings true today, where what good is it to have access to healthcare if you can't afford it?
Yeah, and I think, too, it's important to call out that I think labor unions, to be not dive into it, have a complicated history
yes.
with racial equality.
Absolutely.
So to look back to and for Dr. King to recognize that the struggles of working people are going to raise up a lot of like black and brown people in this country is really important, because a lot of the people he's reaching out to probably less than 5 years ago were doing probably some things that he didn't like. So
yeah,
you know, for him to come out and say things like the labor movement doesn't diminish the nation, but strengthens it.
Yeah.
And calling out a lot of people who were attacking labor at the time, basically calling them out to say, you're really not looking at history, because all of the things that we enjoy now are because of labor unions and things
exactly.
like that. And I think, too, it's really interesting that a lot of the same things that we talk about almost every month here on the show were big parts of the things that he was discussing and tons of people at the time. And especially the right to work stuff.
Yes.
He called that out. I believe he called it a false slogan.
Yeah.
Or different things like that. And he really saw it as a way to destroy the freedom of collective bargaining. And we talked about it a ton today. But just as he said before, basically our weapon is our vote.
Yeah.
And right to work is a huge impediment to that. And all of the work that he did and other people did and throughout then, since then, it's still a fight that we're trying to work on, because there's still lots of confusion and I think misunderstanding of the law today and how it affects people.
Dr. King's call for labor rights, economic fairness, and racial justice rings as true today as it ever did. And so that's our message. Thank you so much for tuning in. We will be back with you again next month. And for Labor Radio, I'm Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilland.
Thank you for listening.
Everyone is crying out for peace. Yes. None is crying out for justice. I don't want no peace. I need equal rights and justice. I need equal rights and justice. I need equal rights.
You're listening to Equal Rights and Justice. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Equal Rights and Justice, where we educate and we agitate and we organize to empower we the people, because another world is possible. Raise up that worldview. The revolutionary king, the MLK, the three evils of society, the sickness of racism, excessive materialism, and militarism, and his prophetic work then for the path forward today.
We're getting ready to deal with the economic issue. We're getting ready to demand jobs and income. We're tired of working full-time jobs for part-time income.
Oh, beautiful, auspicious sky.
Continue our journey. The revolutionary MLK, the three evils of society, the sickness of racism, excessive materialism, and militarism, and his prophetic work then for the path forward today.
It is no longer the choice between violence and nonviolence. It is either nonviolence or non-existence. The alternative to disarmament, the alternative to a greater suspension of nuclear tests, the alternative to strengthening the United Nations and thereby disarming the whole world, may well be a civilization plunged into the abyss of annihilation. And I assure you that I will never adjust to the madness of militarism. You see, it may well be that our whole world is in need at this time for a new organization, the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Maladjustment. Men and women, men and women who will be as maladjusted as the prophet Amos, who in the midst of the injustices of his day could cry out in words that echo across the centuries, "Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream." As maladjusted as the late Abraham Lincoln, the great president of our nation, who had the vision to see that the United States could not survive half slave and half free. As maladjusted as Jesus of Nazareth, who could say to the men and women of his day, "He who lives by the sword will perish by the sword." And through such maladjustment, we will be able to emerge from the long and desolate midnight of man's inhumanity to man into the bright and glittering daybreak of freedom and justice. I still believe that mankind will rise up to the occasion in spite of the darkness of the hour, in spite of the difficulties of the moment, in spite of these days of emotional tension when the problems of the world are gigantic in extent and chaotic in detail, I still have faith in the future. And I still believe that we can build this society of brotherhood and this society of peace. We have a song that we sing in our movement, and we've joined hands to sing it so often beyond, behind jail bars. I can remember times that we've been in jail cells made for 12 people, and yet you would find some 15 or 20 there. But yet we could go on and lift our voices and sing it. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. And somehow I believe that mankind will overcome. And I believe that the forces of evil will be defeated. I believe this because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. I believe that we shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crest earth will rise again. I believe that we shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. And behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. With this faith, we will be able to adjourn the councils of despair and bring new light into the dark chambers of pessimism. With this faith, we will be able to transform this pending cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of peace and brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, Hindus and Muslims, theists and atheists, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last." We have a long, long way to go before this problem is solved. But thank God we've made strides. We've come a long, long way. Before I close by quoting the words of an old Negro slave preacher who didn't quite have his grammar and diction right, but who uttered words of great symbolic profundity. "Lord, we ain't what we want to be. We ain't what we ought to be. We ain't what we gonna be. But thank God, we ain't what we was." Thank you.
1960 who? 1960 what? 1960 who? 19. Hey, the Motor City is burning. That ain't right. 1960 what? 1960 who? 1960 what? 1960 who? 19. Hey, the Motor City is burning, y'all. That ain't right. There was a man, voice of a people, standing on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel. Shots rang out. Yes, it was a gun. He was the only one to fall down, y'all. That ain't right. Then his people scream, ain't no need for sunlight. Ain't no need for moonlight. Ain't no need for streetlight. Just burning real.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg. You've been listening to Equal Rights and Justice.
You're listening to Talking Smart. The official podcast of the International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation Workers.
This is Paul Pimentel, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Ben Nagy, in the control room, Michael Blaine.
Welcome to the 10th episode of Talking Smart. Each month, we bring you news, guests, and discussions of interest to smart members and working families across the United States and Canada. Today, we sit down with two of Smart's national legislative leaders, Steve Dodd and Greg Hines.
Steve and Greg, I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Hi, nice to be here. What a lot of people might not realize are a lot of these insurgents came to Washington, D.C. on Amtrak. They were belligerent on Amtrak trains. They refused to wear masks. They had their signs and their paraphernalia. They were screaming and yelling at other passengers. They were belligerent to our conductors. And when they would be asked to put their mask on, it would get really ugly. They were able to get one of these people off the train. When they searched him, they found out he had a machete in his back. So it's a dangerous time, and there's not nearly enough security at Amtrak or any of our passenger rail stations. And one of the things that we're really working hard on right now is to be able to get the TSA involved with passenger rail and for them to have access to the don't fly list. And anybody who's on a don't fly list should not be allowed to ride passenger rail either.
Not at all. I mean, you figure that if they have the intent to cause mayhem on in an airplane, they would have the same intent to do something on a train. Talking about that, there are like big differences. There's a really huge gap as far as passenger rail safety goes when compared with going on a domestic flight. Can you go into that a little bit?
Amtrak has been reluctant to do that, to beef up the security like airlines, because they think that it makes people less likely to travel using Amtrak, because a lot of people use Amtrak because it doesn't have all those safety measures that you have at the airport. But we're at a point in our country now where we just can't.
We just can't.
We have to keep the passengers and the people who work on the train safe. That's not just our members. That's the onboard services, everyone, the red caps. Everybody's getting abused by these people because they think that they're in the right. They think they're the patriots.
This is the open mic segment where we sit down with General President Sellers. General President Sellers,
many members have asked and commented via social media messages and through email and text about the divisions our nation is currently experiencing. Many have also said they are appalled at what they witnessed last week with the attacks by extremists on our democratic process and on our nation's capital. This sentiment seems to all bear one common theme and one common question. What do you think we can all do as union members
The truth matters. Words matter. And when Donald Trump and his enablers say, be strong and fight like hell, we are coming for you, and trial by combat, those words matter. Let our voice be heard that our government, the system of our government, is for the people and by the people. By letting our voice be heard on accountability, responsibility, and mutual respect of each other. Respect for the law, that your voice matters, that my voice matters, and our views and our differences matter. We will overcome the current state of disunity, but we must bring down the temperature and the aggression. It will take listening and understanding of each other and mutual respect for each other.
Welcome to Your Rights at Work. I'm Chris Garlock. Ed Smith is out this week. The big, the huge labor story today is that Joe Biden, just minutes after being sworn in as president of the United States, asked for the resignation of a guy named Peter Robb by 5 o'clock yesterday. And when Robb refused, Biden fired him last night. Now, to tell us why this is such a big deal for the American labor movement and who exactly Peter Robb is, we asked labor historian Joe McCartan, been on the show many times, to join us. Joe, thanks for taking the time. Appreciate it.
Hi, Chris. Great to be with you.
Boy, you were on my show last night, and Robb had been asked to resign. He was refusing, and now he's been fired. So who is Peter Robb? What's the big deal here?
It's a really significant act, Chris, because Peter Robb has long been a thorn in the side of the labor movement. And it goes back really almost 40 years to the role that Robb played in 1981 when he sought the decertification of the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, PATCO, during their confrontation, their strike in 1981 against the administration of Ronald Reagan. Reagan fired the strikers, as most of your listeners probably know, within 48 hours of their walkout, but they were continuing their strike, and PATCO as an organization was carrying on that fight. They hoped to get themselves rehired, but Robb filed charges against the union under the Federal Labor Relations Act before the Federal Labor Relations Authority. And he saw the case through that got the union decertified. That was a really profoundly important moment for the labor movement because the PATCO strike really signaled the onset of an era of really aggressive union busting. Robb went on after his work in the federal service to work as a employer-side labor lawyer, and then Donald Trump named him as general counsel of the NLRB almost 4 years ago. His term would have run through November, but his tenure as a National Labor Relations Board general counsel was almost uniquely anti-labor in terms of his leanings. He really just sought to gut the agency as best he could. He would not spend all of the money allocated. He tried to centralize control over field offices. He leaned constantly in the direction of employers on cases. And so he had become a real irritant to the labor movement, a real sign of how much the NLRB no longer protected workers and their rights to unionize. And so for Biden to demand his resignation by 5 o'clock yesterday, and then when he didn't receive it, to fire him was just a really symbolic act. In the same way, you might say, as what Robb did in 1981 was a symbolically important act.
We're talking to Joe McCartan. He's professor of history at Georgetown University. He's also executive director of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor. He also wrote a little book called Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. You say it's a symbolic act. It's actually, I'm going to say it's more than a symbolic. This is firing somebody. That's real. That's rubber hitting the road. And he asked for the resignation first, gave him a way out. And then I think when we were talking last night in the show, we already knew that Rob was refusing to go, which was going to be, it was going to raise some interesting questions because this has only happened once before. I think you were saying back in when the first first general council, 1950, so 60, 70 years ago, my God.
Yeah.
So there was going to be some interesting questions about that. But that Biden went ahead, pulled the trigger and fired him. This seems to me to be really significant.
It is, as you say, Chris. General counsels serve four-year terms, and it's been since 1950 when Harry Truman sought the resignation of a general counsel named Robert Denham that any president during a transition has felt that the general counsel was so inimical in the way that they were doing their job that they needed to be summarily removed on the spot. But that's the kind of figure Peter Robb had been. He had really seemingly left no stone unturned in his efforts to use his power as general counsel to weaken the labor movement. Yeah, it's more than symbolism. It's a real act of resolve on the part of the Biden administration. It sends an important signal.
Joe, thanks so much for being with us. As always, keep up the great work and also always providing us with a historical perspective. We really need it, and I appreciate it.
Love it, Chris. Take care. Bye.
All right, that's Joe McCartan. He's a professor of history at Georgetown University, executive director of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor, and as I mentioned, author of the classic labor book, Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed in America.
Hello, working people of Southwest Washington.
You're listening to episode 14 of Working to Live in Southwest Washington, produced by the Southwest Washington Central Labor Council. We're also a proud member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Find out more about the network at laborradionetwork.org.
And I hope you haven't forgotten about me. I'm Shannon Myers.
And I'm Harold Phillips. So, how's it going over there in the Myers house, Shannon? Sounds like kids have some opinions.
I do have a 16 and a 14-year-old. Man, trying to explain to them what happened last week on January 6th in D.C. was crazy.
Yeah.
How do you explain to your kids that there are people who have literally been lied to and are out of their minds, and then they storm the Capitol and they have a noose. A police officer died. Another one committed suicide. How do you explain this to your children? I really hope that they hold these people accountable.
We have Joe Kindo, the government affairs director at the Washington State Labor Council, and his assistant. Thanks for joining us, Joe.
Hey, thank you. Yes, this is Evan. He is my deputy director of government affairs. He turns 1 year old next week.
I love to see him. You know what? We're all working people. We all got kids. Joe, I love to see you with your little one.
Thank you for having me on. This is great. I really appreciate it. And I think this is a great model for communication that other regional labor councils should take a look at.
We couldn't agree more about that. But Joe, let's talk a little bit about this session, because we've been talking to Monica Stonier and Annette Cleveland about what's different this year with the pandemic, with the unrest that we experienced in Washington, D.C. last week. What's different for the State Labor Council as they go to the legislature and advocate for working people?
I think the immediate functional difference, aside from the remote nature of the session, is just the limited capacity there is to accomplish legislation. It takes about twice as long to do the same thing. Bill hearings take twice as long. Floor debate seems to take twice as long. And I do have to hand it to the legislators themselves. They have gone through quite a bit of preparation and work to get to a place where I think that they'll functionally be able to legislate. It's just that pipeline is going to be a lot more narrow. And you're seeing that in bill introductions. There are much fewer bills being introduced every day than in previous sessions.
That brings up a question that I have, Joe. I heard that they were only going to hear a certain amount of bills, that they were basically capping the number. Are they putting limitations like that on bills? And how does that affect the bills that you guys are selecting to push this session?
Yeah, to your first question, I think the House has a semi-formal cap of 7 bills per member. I don't think the Senate is quite as formal about it, but I think all legislators are being very judicious about what they put out there. I think there's a real focus on bills that help us react to the COVID pandemic, bills that help avert or mitigate climate disaster. They're hearing bills with respect to racial equity and policing, and bills to make sure that the budget and state and local government have the resources they need to do all the work they need to do. For us, that means we're elevating bills that have a direct impact on health and safety enforcement, that have a direct impact on revenue and providing the services and jobs we need through state spending, and doing that in a way that doesn't further burden or impact working families. And unemployment insurance, you know, is another really big one that we have to make some real strides on. And then childcare and jobs, making sure people are able to go to work and that we have a transportation investment package that's going to put people to work. Those are the highlights of our legislative agenda. And then there are a couple of bills we're also working on that are pandemic adjustment bills, things related to pension service credit for public workers who are furloughed or doing shared work, some technical stuff like that.
Joe, you just gave us a big list of priorities. How are you going to accomplish that? And more importantly, how can people listening to this work with you?
I think the most important thing, especially organized workers can do, is being responsive to the asks that their individual unions put out to engage. That aside, the State Labor Council also maintains a couple of websites. The one that's most public facing is thestand.org. And that's where a lot of our call to actions go. There are links for accessing your legislature. There are links for petitions and letter drives and calls to action. But I think the most important thing that people can do is communicate a sense of values to their legislator. You don't need talking points to do that. It's just reaching out to them however you communicate, with a pen and paper or an email or a phone call, and letting them know the kinds of things that you think they really need to lean into.
So
the hardest part, of course, is cutting through all the static. Nobody's taking in-person meetings, right? There are no in-person lobby days. There are no coffee meetings on the weekends. So anything that people can do to stand out, I honestly think written letters are really impactful. Thousands of people are going to send emails, right? Hundreds will make phone calls. Those are good, important things to do. But if you can take the time to fill out a postcard or write a letter, that's tactile. It'll take a little longer to get to the legislator, of course, but I'll tell you, it'll stick with them.
Joe, what you're talking about here is lobbying on an issue. And people have a reaction to that term, lobbying, lobbyist. Is it worth people's time, do you think, to lobby their legislators?
I do. And I am a paid registered lobbyist. That's my job. But lobbying itself is really just the act of communicating to a legislator or a policymaker of some kind. The legislators hear from me all the time. They don't hear from the people I represent all the time. And so those voices, your voices out there listening to this podcast, can be really powerful. And I know people can get really cynical about lawmakers, and I understand that, but being a legislator is not a fun job. It does not pay well. It drags you across the state in most instances. It keeps you away from your family. Really long nights or long days and into the night. Anytime they can make a connection with somebody in their district, that's valuable to them. It makes the work worthwhile to them. And so is it worth your time as a non-professional lobbyist, everyday person to go talk? Absolutely. Absolutely. If there's something you care about or something you think is going to impact you.
Thank you, Joe Kindo, Government Affairs Director for the Washington State Labor Council. And thank you, working people, for joining us on another episode of Working to Live in Southwest Washington, produced by the Southwest Washington Central Labor Council.
Hey, Harold, know what else you can tell your state legislatures this session?
Huh.
You could tell them that this podcast was recorded under a SAG-AFTRA collective bargaining agreement, and you hope they'll support others as well.
They're going to be glad to hear that. They might think that'll keep me from bugging them about Washington's film incentive program every year. They'd be wrong, though. We've got a long way to go to heal from what happened last week in D.C. But the only way we're going to do that is if we can all agree to live together.
And all agree on what the truth is.
We'll see you soon.
Bye.
Good afternoon, machinist members of District Lodge 141, and to all our viewers everywhere. This is the 141 Report, and I'm your host, Dave Lehigh, a communications representative for District Lodge 141. This week, our Zoom interview travels to Burlingame, California, as we speak to the president of Local 1782. Wendy, it's great to see you. So what's your background, work experience, your airline job history, and the history you have had as a union member and the jobs you've held with the local?
Absolutely. I've definitely spent a good amount of time at the airline. This year, I will be celebrating 24 years with United Airlines and SFO, and time sure has flown. Couldn't imagine that in all these years that we'd have all the different things. But in San Francisco, I've pretty much worked about every area in customer service at the airport. I worked the gates, lobby, baggage, international arrivals, club, Polaris, and also global service now. And in all those various areas, it's definitely been interesting through all the times we've had the highs and the lows. Travel's my passion, and I love to travel, and I enjoy helping my members, at least the airport side. And then on the union side, probably about 10 years or so ago, I can't remember, it all starts to blend in together. Greg had asked me to be a shop steward and to give it a try, and I did. And since then, I've been shop steward for quite a while. I also did assistant committee for a while, and I was, before this current position as president, I was the VP for our local lodge. And I've also had the pleasure of getting to attend all the leadership classes at Whipping Singer the year before. I did do the final one of Train the Trainer. And it was just amazing all the different experiences along the way I've gotten to gain by going to conventions or training or meetings and just getting to learn and get experience and ideas and share ideas with other members and gaining some knowledge to help our membership out there.
So let me ask you, how big is Local 1782 and what cities do you represent?
So our local lodge, let's say in January of last year, we had 1,754 members. We represent quite a diverse. We do have two districts there. We have 142 and 141. On 142, we have the British Airways San Francisco, and we have Southwest. We have Sacramento, San Jose, San Francisco, and Oakland. And then for United, we have Reno, we have Sacramento, we have San Jose, and we have San Francisco.
I want to thank you, Wendy, for taking the time to come on today's program and speaking to our viewers.
And thank you. And I just want to say, everyone, don't forget to wear your mask. You want to stay safe and keep our fellow brothers and sisters and families safe during this time. We will survive this. We're union strong, and we will get past this.
This wraps up this week's program. We'll see you next week. Till then, remember to stay safe, healthy, and have a good weekend. Bye for now.
Step by step along this march can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly none, and by union what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill, singly none, singly none.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. On tonight's show, Kansas City native Thomas Frank has a new book about American populism and the long line of elites who hate it. It's called The People? No, A Brief History of Anti-Populism. Find out why pundits called Donald Trump a populist and why he's nothing of the kind.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. Thomas Frank is one of the latest Kansans to achieve national fame as a culture critic, historian, and the guy who makes sense of this crazy political world we live in. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Judy, great to be here.
The book that we're talking about is called The People Know, or say it yourself, Tom. How do you say it?
The People Know.
That's it.
And so Carl Sandburg wrote a famous book-length poem back in the 30s called The People Yes, The Celebration of Ordinary mm-hmm. Americans. Uh-huh. And the idea is that we're living in a very different time than that, when no one wants to celebrate ordinary Americans.
So tell us, why isn't Trump a populist one?
The way the pundit class uses the word populism, they use it as a kind of synonym for racist demagogue. And that usage of the word was out there already, but it was in conflict with the sort of original definition of the word, which is someone who's concerned about economic democracy, you know, a sort of Bernie Sanders kind of character. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of, you know, the sort of traditional American definition of the word. But thanks to Trump and thanks to Brexit in England, this kind of alternative definition just completely conquered everything. And now it's commonly used as the only definition, and people look at you funny if you use the word to mean, you know, something sane.
Something good.
This sort of traditional look, the definitions of words change, and it's kind of ridiculous mission to go out there and complain about the definition of a word changing. What's far more interesting is to look at why the definition of the word changed, who is responsible for changing it, why did they do this, and what do they mean by it? And that's, once you start digging down into that, it's a very interesting story. So what I do is I trace the kind of history of populist, genuine populist movements in American life, but also the history of people who hate populism. Mm-hmm. And that, Judy, is absolutely fascinating, because there's this strong, I shouldn't say undercurrent, because it's in some ways it's dominant, this cultural current in American life of despising mass movements of working people. My book starts in the 1890s with the birth of populism, the people who actually invented the word. But I'm sure you could trace it back earlier than that. But I trace anti-populism from the 1890s up to the present, people who absolutely hate and despise and fear mass movements of working class people.
So this is basically a history of the opposition to popular change in America going through our history, at least since the 1890s.
Yeah, that's right. It's a history of progressive left-wing movements, and also of people who hate those movements. And then down to our own time, when everything goes through the looking glass and everything is upside down, and Richard Nixon is a populist and
Donald Trump.
Trump does have a certain way of talking that resonates for a lot of working class people. And he does, I'll give him this. He occupies a kind of populist space in a kind of left-wing space in our political system. So you got to look at this in the larger picture, Judy. The left-wing party in America, I should say the party of the left in our two-party system, which is the Democrats, has for 40 years now has really not been interested in being a traditional party of the left. And so what's happening is these sort of other movements and other figures rising up to occupy this position formerly filled by the Democratic Party, but doing it without actually, so pretending to care about working people without actually doing anything for them, coming up with all of these culture war ways of reaching out to working people without actually helping them out economically. Traditional parties of the left are about economic reforms that will benefit working class people. That is the definition of the left, going all the way back. And then you have a bunch of other features of it, but that's the central feature of it. And so you have the right in America, and Trump didn't originate this, by the way. Trump was very upfront about it, but he didn't invent this strategy of reaching out to working class voters without actually doing anything for them.
One of the most interesting parts of the book to me was in the chapter where you quote Martin Luther King, and we're recording this on Martin Luther King Day. And so I thought I would read, I thought this was really interesting that Jim Crow and the Jim Crow laws were in part a response to the threat of the racial unity that the populists were building.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you quote Martin Luther King to say, "And when his wrinkled stomach cried out for the food that his empty pockets could not provide," talking about white Southerners, "he ate Jim Crow, a psychological bird that told him that no matter how bad off he was, at least he was a white man, better than the black man, and he ate Jim Crow."
Yeah. And so that's in his famous speech that King gave, and he gave that speech in March of 1965. I remember that easily because it was within a week of when I was born, the day I was born. On the steps of the Capitol building in Montgomery, Alabama. This is at the very end of the Selma to Montgomery march. And it's a moment of supreme triumph for Martin Luther King. Congress is working. They're going to get the Voting Rights Act passed. So it's for him. It's one of his great moments and one of his great speeches. You can watch it on YouTube. It's one of the all time classics. And he gives a shout out in the speech to the original populist movement in the 1890s. He says, where did these awful laws, where did Jim Crow come from? Because when he gives his speech, there at the very end of Jim Crow is going down all over the South. They're not going to be able to do segregation by law any longer. And so he says, let's look back. Where did this system come from? And it is really interesting that it was invented. It was devised as a way of making sure that something like populism never happened again, that there would never be another effort to bring together poor whites and poor blacks in the South. And that's actually, you know, what's funny about that is that we look around us and all these people using the word populism just willy-nilly to mean whatever the hell they want. When Martin Luther King used it, it was clinically exact. He's actually historically totally correct in the way that he uses that word. That's one of the things that I really like about that speech.
Thank you very much, Thomas Frank. We've been talking to Thomas Frank, author of The People Know, A Brief History of Anti-Populism. Thank you so much.
You got it.
Appreciate it. There is no disgrace in standing.
Welcome to the Harmony of Interest series, where we will explore ideas that positively shape our world. I'm very excited to talk to Dr. Harvey J. Kay, who's a professor emeritus of democracy and justice studies at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. He's an award-winning author and has published 16 books on history, politics, and revolutionary ideas. And today we'll be discussing his book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. Professor, thanks so much for your time.
No, this is a pleasure, all the more because it's a labor podcast. Thank you.
So could you provide a scene setter of the state of the world when Roosevelt took office in 1933?
Okay, well, we all know the Great Depression. We all know of the crash of 1929. And we've seen plenty of images that conjure up mass unemployment, homelessness, loss of farmsteads, Hoovervilles, as they were known, you know, the shanty towns. The unemployment rate officially, you know, was something like 20%, but quite likely it was far higher because there was a lot of underemployment. We're talking about a situation which was the worst economic and social catastrophe in American history. And in those first 100 days, they enacted controls over the banks. They enacted the National Industrial Recovery Act, which, as long as we're on a labor podcast, it's important to note, it actually included, number one, the very first federal minimum wage, okay? And the second thing it included was collective bargaining rights for workers. But that immediately unleashed massive worker organizing. I mean, companies didn't know what hit them, and the only way they could respond was they started creating all the more company unions to try to prevent real labor unions from entering into their industries.
I do want to actually focus on the 1940 State of the Union speech, where the Four Freedoms was introduced. And in some ways, you know, war is raging in Europe at this time. I believe the Nazis have already taken over large swaths of Europe.
Yeah. Look, East Asia was becoming part of the, you know, the Japanese Empire. Hitler basically had control over Europe and was doing quite well down in North Africa. It looked like fascism, as at least one American said, who, shamefully, might be the wave of the future, which FDR utterly rejected, because as far as he was concerned, the wave of the future had to be democratic, small d, democratic.
And part of it is, if you're going to war, you need to not just be fighting this enemy, you need to be fighting for something. And that's where this introduction of the Four Freedoms, and we know a lot about the freedom of speech, the freedom of religion, but the two other freedoms, could you talk a little bit more about that and what those were?
Yeah, he talks about freedom from want. It was to create an international economy that allowed every nation to provide for the needs of its citizens, and freedom from fear that would reduce the growth in armaments and provide for international security. Working people heard freedom from want and freedom from fear and imagined that what they had been doing during the 1930s in fighting the New Deal and in creating labor unions, that was a massive growth in labor organizing. I mean, unprecedented growth in labor organizing, that they believed that the right, that freedom of speech and freedom from want was a further endorsement that labor unionism would in fact grow. And then, as you know, Evan, in 1944, 3 years later in the State of the Union message, he goes all the more progressive. And he says, he wants to, if you might say, he's giving immediate life to the ideals of the Four Freedoms. And he calls for an economic bill of rights.
And in those, it's right to work, food, clothing, leisure, you know, the living wage, and making sure that everyone has housing, medical care, social security, education.
You know, one more thing, like the four R's: relief, recovery, reconstruction, and reform. Now, just last night, from when we're speaking, Joe Biden has taken step one, relief. Okay, but now the question is for the labor movement to stop being deferential. And the labor movement from the top of the AFL-CIO down must take action to push for recovery, reconstruction, and reform. And when we say reform, we mean workers' rights.
Harvey Kay, I really appreciate your time.
Appreciate having been invited, and it was really, really enjoyable talking with you. And solidarity.
That's it for this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 80 labor radio shows and podcasts that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today. You can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Patrick Dixon and Evan Papp, produced by me, and our social media guru, as always, is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Labor Radio Net and find out more on our website at laborradionetwork.org. Also, check out our weekly live stream show available at Labor Radio Net on Facebook and Labor Radio Podcast Network's YouTube, where you'll also find profiles of members of the network. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio podcast show. See you next time. Racial